fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I do not know whether the gods are faces that we give to that which is faceless in order to comprehend it and be close to it as human beings. If they are manifestations of distinct powers arising from an unknowable immensity or supreme reality or a oneness. If they are mediators or messengers between us and the God who is beyond comprehension. If they are aspects of nature and the world personified. If they are archetypes or forces of consciousness both within and without man. Or if they are at the highest human expression of being beyond mortality. Perhaps they are a combination of all of the above. What I do know is that the gods are mysteries, and that we as human beings are ultimately drawn to them. And I know that they respond if one calls out to them. In times when the shrouds between worlds are temporarily unveiled, when our universe expands, they make themselves manifest. For this to happen, one has to live poetically and live strongly. One has to live a life of great deeds, of overcoming, a life worthy of divine attention. One has to boldly face great sorrow and greater joy, for the gods have no interest in dull normalcy. Infinite divinities await, hidden within man himself, which is always the place of the final pilgrimage. The godlight becomes living reality when dreams intersect with the waking world. These are knife-edge moments when the mythic cuts through the temporal to reveal the timeless, where the spirit is elevated to its superior states, where the poetic takes flight over the rational. In moments such as these, the gods awaken and reclaim their seat in the soul. We can hear them when we call out for them, in the crash of thunder and in the whisper of rustling leaves, in the creak of frosted towering evergreens and in the roar of waves, in the solemn song of eternal dawn and in the ecstatic cries of battle and love. And we wait for the furor of their return. Burn, baby, burn. The gods are coming.
Free your mind.
What is he doing?
He's beginning to believe.
Happy heresies and welcome to the desert of the real. You just heard my favorite description of the gods that I have ever read from our guest, from his other excellent book, Journeys in the Kali Yuga. And to me, it's always stirring and it hits it on the nail. And the bottom line, we can discuss the gods, but we can't live a life of normalcy. We have to be bold to get through those portals to lift the veil. So I hope you enjoyed it. I hope YouTube doesn't strike it out as it often did, especially when we get close to the truth, but we shall see. My name is Miguel Connor. I am your Pompidus of Gnosis, and I welcome you on this day of Mercury. Good to see people always already in the chat, like Christina, H.P. Lovecraft, Benjamin, and others. And today I am very excited to have for a sequel the amazing Aki Sederberg, this time to discuss his book, Holy Europe. Where's that camera? There you go. Aki, thank you very much for coming back on the show.
Thank you, Miguel. Great being here. And that is a beautiful reading you do there of that passage.
Well, thank you. Again, it's a wonderful book, just like Holy Europe. Your writing is amazing, and I can tell you are there, you're experiencing these things, and you really translate them well. So it will be a great book to cover, like your last book. And with us, too, we got Graham Pong. Graham, how are you doing? Are you meeting the gods?
As often as they will let me.
You know, I try not to bug them too much. If you bug them too much, you don't like the outcome. At least I don't.
Yeah, well,
I'm looking. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have found the enemy, and the enemy is often us. So that's always the danger. Yeah, they're going to change your life forever. They're going to throw everything upside down, and your old self will die, and your relationships will end, and you will be in the middle of a new labyrinth, but at least it's a more real labyrinth. So it is. Anyway, for those of you on the chat, please, if you have any questions for Aki or complaints against Graham and I, please super chat them so we can separate them. We already got a good crowd, already over more 50 this early on. And again, it should be a good one. So Aki, tell us, for starters, how did you, why did you write Holy Europe? Excuse me. What made you write Holy Europe?
So, yes, some people may remember I was on your show earlier and I kind of told my sort of origin story, what resulted in me writing the first book, which was Journeys in the Kali Yuga, which is about me delving into the Indian esoteric or a branch of the Indian esoteric tradition, which was basically because I was homesick. I was looking for a sense of home or a deeper connection. And I found that in my own homeland and in Europe, in a broader sense, that connection was missing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of paganism in Europe, but a lot of it is resting on very sort of elusive foundations. And it's in ways a broken tradition because the living lines of authority are missing. So I wanted to see a similar path, a similar religion in a way, through my experience of India. And, you know, India in many ways is similar to European paganism. The most similar, I think, of the world religions that exist today. It is polytheism in a way and has this sort of broad church, so to speak, approach to the divine. And that my first book details my sort of decade of delving into the Indian tradition, at the end of which I discovered that it's you know, you cannot go into another cultural tradition like that without, in a sense, cutting ties with your own native tradition, your own home, and your own family, in a way. You know, you have to completely sort of cut ties with that and enter into a new world. And that wasn't really my destiny, my dharma, so to speak. It wasn't the path that I was supposed to take, and I don't think it's a path that is open for most Westerners. There are exceptions, but most Westerners, I think, would have a hard time going down that path. Of course, I speak specifically of the path that I went down, which is the Naga Babas, the Naga Sadhus, and the Juna Akara, into which I received an initiation. But after having delved into this Indian tradition, it gave me a mirror by which to look at my own culture and my own landscape in a more clear, perhaps, way. And so this is kind of a continuation, Holy Europe, of this seeking of this elusive spiritual center of Europe. What is it? And how do we approach it in the modern time? What do ancient gods mean to modern people? Do they have any relevance? How do we approach them? Do they talk back? You know, what is this, what is missing? And so Holy Europe then is this kind of exploration of this elusive spiritual center of Europe. And I use this on the cover of the book. You have an image of a manifestation of the world tree. Now, this happens to be a mountaintop in Germany where they have this tradition of a sort of axis mundi, a tree of the world that is raised, and the wreath is replaced every year in this spring ceremony. And so that's why that's on the cover there. And I explore sort of nine branches of the European world tree. And on the cover of the book, as you were showing, there is it is a cross-like figure, but it's also a sun wheel.
Yeah.
So it sort of combines aspects of paganism and Christianity, and sort of is a synthesis of those two things in a way. And paganism and Christianity really are the two major streams which, on the tension of which the whole of Europe is based. I mean, the whole of Europe and European history and religion really comes down to these two streams of paganism, pre-Christian polytheism, and then the later Christian religion, which of course adopted many aspects of paganism into itself. And so this is my sort of time-bound exploration of these topics in this time. I'm now pretending to be in some other place, and so I'm exploring also like contemporary Europe and how, what these sacred sites look like today, and how can we approach them, and what are the difficulties we face when approaching them, and also what is the relevance of all these things. So that is it, really, in a nutshell. The holy really is the sort of mythic transcendent center or the symbolic story upon which our whole culture is based. And sacred sites, holy sites, are those places, not arbitrary places, but those places in which the holy makes itself manifest to us and in which we can experience the holy, because that is the central thing. We need to be able to experience and access this dimension. And that's why I'm approaching it as a sort of, in a way, my personal travelogue, where I go to these places and I seek these things, and then I try to be honest about what I find, because you don't always find what you want, and you don't always access. Like, it's not easy. So this is what I try to do. I try to find these elusive gods, as you played in the clip in the beginning. You know, for myself, of course, primarily, and then as a writer, I try to communicate my experience to others, and hopefully that will give something to them as well.
No, it's a wonderful book, and for the audience, yeah, he goes to so many places, obviously Finland, Sweden, Germany, France, Spain, we'll talk about Portugal, Italy, and so many pictures of these sites, these portals, and the things you saw. It's very evocative and engaging, and I think it's important too, Aki, what you're doing, because obviously we finally are out of a time where we have to worry about the Abrahamic religions suppressing and not allowing us to the materials or connecting, excuse me, to these old spirits. But as you say, suddenly, okay, now we have the opportunity, and people in Europe seem to be like shrugging their shoulders, or they're guilty or whatever, to these ancient myths and cultures, which are essential for the very survival of the continent. I mean, it's true. I mean, this is it's a fact. I mean, and I was thinking, you know, if I were to move to China, Peru, or France, doesn't matter, I would want to look at the mythology, the religion, the sites, so I could understand the people and get my psyche aligned with the people. So nothing to do with immigration, or, you know, it's where you are in the land, you have to honor the land, right? And you yourself, you got some blowback from this book when you published it first in Finnish, right?
Well, I mean, a surprisingly very minor blowback.
Oh, okay.
It was mostly very well received. I was actually surprised by, you know, the major newspapers wrote about it, mostly in very positive ways, and people were very excited about this book, and whatever criticism came towards it came from very sort of, you know, marginal voices on the internet, which isn't really doesn't bother just me.
Trolls, yeah,
yeah, trolls. Yeah, and a sort of also like a sort of resentment. You know, Nietzsche talks about this kind of grudge, this kind of a hatred of whatever is beautiful and noble, because people aren't able to hold those ideals themselves, so they hate anything that sort of doesn't present itself in this sort of apologizing way. And, you know, of course, that's just my name. I'm not, you know, I try to be honest, and I think you have to be strong about these things. You can't be like, well, I'm sorry, you know, I think this way and present this. But I think about what you said earlier, I think, you know, there's this old thing about the shaman, how he goes and recovers a lost part of a person's soul. Mm-hmm. There's this idea that a person can lose a part of their soul or spirit, and it can become trapped in the underworld or something like that. And the shaman is there to rediscover that soul and bring it back. So there's this kind of soul loss that is talked about in a lot of these native traditions. And I think this can be extended to collectives as well. And I think on some strange level, Europeans have collectively lost a part of their soul.
Right.
And I don't think it's anybody else's fault necessarily. I think it's a unique situation of European people where they've lost touch with their spiritual homeland, their roots, their sense of self, and their sort of their connection with the transcendent or with the divine. And I think it might have something to do with the very external approach that Europeans have had to the world. You know, the Oswald Spengler, the cultural historian, who speaks of this sort of Faustian soul, of how Europeans are this, or he talks of Western people, are sort of right. outward oriented. Everything is about conquering space, conquering the sea, climbing the mountain, going where no one has gone before, like in Star Trek, I guess. Or, you know, this whole idea of like going yeah. further, going farther, and the, all of the architecture, you know, beginning from the Viking ships to the Gothic cathedrals to the spaceships, is this like external projection of the spirit or the soul. But I think maybe in the process of this Faustian impulse, Westerners or Europeans have lost touch with their inner impulse or some part of their soul, because I find it a very unique situation that Europeans are sort of experiencing on a collective level. And if I can in any way, in any meager way, help point to some kind of land or some sort of sense of rootedness and groundedness that can have, you know, help people discover something that has been lost, I think I would be very happy about that.
Yeah, for sure. And you're right about the Oswald Spengler, because... Yeah, the Faustians, like you said, we called them colonizers. We got to expand and take the research. We'll make a deal with the devil now and pay for it later. And it has been a blowback, and it just doesn't include Europeans. I think he talks like year 1000. So you have to include the Mongols and other groups that just decided we are going to go on this colonizing, conquering. Because, yes, Spengler says, the Greeks and the Romans, yeah, they had empires, but they were very limited in size. They weren't that big as we want to think, even Alexander the Great, and they had a certain connection. What they conquered, they connected with the land. They honored the gods. They honored the culture. They were, I mean, it was, like you said, very different. And it's time to move on and, you know, address their shadow. Americans need to address their shadow while still honoring the land. Now, a point I wanted to bring too, which I saw another commonality in your book, is the idea of Hermes. And we can say Hermes or Dionysus, because obviously with the Orphics, who were so huge, they're really so important to the culture, to the Western culture. Dionysus and Hermes are kind of the same, right? They're gods of the people. They're gods of nature. They're gods that help the middle and lower classes. They don't see differences and they reward people. They're gods of the land, but they're also psychopomps to the, they're like gods of the shamans, right? And we see that, maybe give us some examples in Western Europe. Obviously, the Romans had no problem saying that Odin and those gods were Mercury. They associated them with Mercury. And as you see, there's a lot of this proto-Hermeticism in Western Europe, even in the Scandinavia, right?
Well, it's a very, very complex question. Yes, mm-hmm. And I agree. There are similarities with Odin and Hermes as this sort of traveler between worlds that relays information or knowledge or wisdom, you know, from other spheres to people.
Right.
I mean, there are people who say that Odin might be some sort of later addition to the Nordic pantheon. Even I've heard this. I have no idea if this is true or not. I mean, there are overriding similarities between European peoples in their divinities and in the way that they approach the divine. There is very often an idea of a sky father or a thunderer or and a thunderer, and there's deities that travel between these worlds. And then there's this sense of a sacred mother of earth, and their relationship creates all life. And I mean, this is just to give some examples, but, you know, obvious examples. But I find that there's a lot of shared ground between the European pantheons, and Europeans have a tendency to sort of emphasize their differences, whereas I have been trying in this book to find the commonalities, the common, what is the common sort of, what are the common spiritual aspects that are common through the European cultures? What are these things that tie us together? And I think there are clearly threads that you can find, such as the nature of the divine, how to approach it, the idea of sacred time and the cyclical view of the world, and the idea of man and man's place in the universe and what his role should be. And I think, you know, regional differences, languages, ethnic cultures, these are all real things, but there is also a sort of kindred spiritedness or a commonality between these European pantheons. I don't know if you had any question or I answered any question you
were giving. No, that's it. The commonalities. And again, I think, Dionysus, it's not just, he's not the god of the wine. What he represents really, and you show in your work, really manifests in other cultures from Scandinavia to Western Europe. And of course, Hermes, what he represents, like you said, the shaman, the psychopomp, the bringer of gifts, often the trickster. And he appears as Odin, and he appears in many Western European spirits and gods. So yeah, there is these commonalities, and it really shows a beauty that regardless of continent, there is, can be one spirit, one people, one, as you said, one looking for the divine, one path that we can take to look for the divine. And it brings unity, I think, when we see these things, and lifts up the mystery that is happening in the land and gets us connected to the land. Ultimately, that's what Dionysus and Hermes would want us, get connected to the land, because that is a spiritual place and it has so many portals. Would you agree with that?
I would agree. And I would also say Apollo, then, if we want to go the Greco-Roman route. I mean, I think you have to have both. You have to have the sort of light and order and clarity and, whatever Apollo represents, although Apollo, funnily enough, is also a god of poetry and music, and has some similarities to Dionysus. But we need both the deities of sky and of earth, not just one or the other. And there tends to be, you know, an overemphasis with people on one or the other sort of aspect. But I think a central quality to European paganism is this idea of a balance of light and dark forces, of the male and the female, or the masculine and the feminine, the sort of masculine and feminine divine features of the universe, or of God. And I think we should revere both of these things.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And for the audience, you did some of the rituals. One that stuck out to me, you did a ritual for the Germanic goddess Ostara. I think you were in Sweden at the time. Was that the one of the most, your favorite ones? Or maybe tell the audience some of the your rituals that really stuck out to you that you remember.
Well, I mean, what is ritual? Ritual is action on a mythic level.
Right.
And of course, me being from Finland and having ancestry in Scandinavia and the North in general, my path is of the North. That's my sort of spiritual homeland in a broader sense. I mean, what is the North? The North is the direction of danger, of mystery, of Hyperborea, of light, the kingdom of Apollo they spoke of.
Yeah.
It is a bunch of these things, you know. It is kind of represents this ideal that's both a paradise and a dangerous, perhaps mirage even. So I have a very sort of northern spiritual attitude just based on my cultural background. And however, I mean, my strongest connection still is to my own Finnic tradition. And with writing these books, I have also started doing more rituals and upholding things of the Finnic tradition, because I think that's an aspect that's often overlooked and not practiced. And so I'm trying in my own way to do ritual work, which is done, I mean, in this context, if we speak of rituals in sort of in any kind of semi-public way, they are done to maintain the cosmic order and balance. They're done to sort of uphold the center. And this is done via the celebration of the cyclical festivities, cyclical rites, calendar rites, as well as rites of passage. So coming into being, unity, and passing into new being. So birth, marriage, union, and death, passing into new being. So when we go through life, we have to go through these portals to make our life meaningful and have a sense of meaningful structure. And that's what these rites of passage are there for. They're there to sort of structure and anchor us into the eternal. Just as much as these calendar rites and cyclical time is there to anchor us into whatever is beyond time. So we have these points in time that sort of anchor us to whatever is beyond it. A sacred time, sacred reality, so that when we go about our life, we have these moments when we connect to something that is higher. And this is in every day of our life, you know, moves in a cycle. We wake up in the morning, the sun hits its apex, and then it starts receding, goes into the underworld, and next day it's born again. And all of human life, and all of life really on this planet, goes according to this cyclical seasonal way. So this is really the sense of ritual. Now, I can't really... Then there are, of course, personal rituals that one does for personal connection, development, and various reasons. And it's hard to say, you know, what was my favorite ritual, but I feel very blessed to have been part of many ritual fires where I felt that the fire has been mirroring my own fire. And of course, these are points of convergence where the sun and the moon are sort of simultaneously in the sky, and everything is happening at once. And you have sort of these short moments of experiencing the simultaneousness of everything. You can see the past, the present, and the future, and glimpses of these things. And this is what I've experienced. And I tell of some of these things in the book. Sometimes they would surprise me in their magnificence and power. And sometimes the gods are mute. And that's the nature. It's not always, you know, there's people who are in touch with various entities all the time. And I'm certainly not one of those people, although I have been oriented towards these elusive gods my whole life. But I'm not claiming to be a psychic or have some sort of hotline to the divine. So I value those rare moments in which I actually feel that, okay, there's something is speaking to me, the universe is communicating. And that's not every day, and that's not easy, but it's certainly important and real. And it's a very real human experience that I think has guided most of our culture in a way.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Really well said. And as you were saying, we go back to Hermes, as above, so below. The ancients weren't just subservient to the gods. Like you're saying, our rituals, our reenacting the myth, what we do down in here actually helps the universe stay on course in harmony. As the Jewish saying goes, the God needs us as much as we need him. It's a team. It's a spectrum where it's not, oh, please help me and don't throw thunder at me. It was more nuanced with these ancients. And again, they were more connected to the world and the universe and the numinous, as Jung would call it. So there is one passage I want to read before we get into what a lot of people here want to hear about your visit to Cathar land, to Languedoc. But let me read this paragraph from your book. As you're going through France, I believe, you write, "These deeply rooted pagan folk traditions do not correspond to our modern image of a harmless nature religion in which man lives in harmony with a perpetually smiling Mother Earth. For our pre-modern ancestor, nature was not just the womb from which all life springs, but also the tomb in which it inevitably ends. Sexuality begins what death completes, binding those two primal powers together. Darkness is as present as light, and destruction follows creation. The eternal dance and counterbalance of these forces form the cycle of life, such as our ancestors knew it. Later, with the advent of the religions of the city, primarily Christianity, the old gods and the elemental forces of nature had to retreat in the wake of a new god. The practitioners of the old ways were called pagans, meaning country dwellers or villagers. Their life and work were tied to the land and soil." So I think that describes more or less what you were experiencing and seeing behind the scenes and in another time.
Yes.
Yeah, for the audience, there are many passages. He's not just describing, oh, I went today and I saw, you know, a sculpture of Ukko, the Finnish. You know, you're actually trying to feel the land, right? Feel the history, talk to people and see what this folk traditions are telling you, right, Aki?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in that passage, I was also criticizing the way that urban pagans sort of revere nature, or they talk about nature as if it's this like benevolent mother only. And I mean, this is not how, you know, people in the past have experienced nature, at least in places where you had to struggle with food and cold and things. It is not like that. And I think it would be important that people get a little bit more realistic about what nature actually is and what that means. I mean, of course, we should revere nature and respect it, but the ancient people were not tree huggers like, you know, today, that you know, they have a very safe and cushy existence, and on their spare time they can go to a park and hug trees. It wasn't like that. Their literal life and death was tied to the land in a different way. And so I think, you know, you have to sort of appreciate and understand and accept also these sort of harsh realities of nature. It's not all joyous and beautiful. It's also cruel and fairly indifferent to various living creatures, you know.
Very true. What most people think is nature is not nature. It's we've tamed nature. We've shackled Gaia and created situations where we're safer to survive. But true nature is, yeah, very complex. So I'd like to bring in Graham. Graham, any questions or comments so far?
No, I've been very much enjoying it. The one thing that jumped out to me was in the Norse pantheon, one of the biggest parallels to Hermes that I've always noticed is Loki. He seemed very much like a Hermes type character, where so much of what the gods have, their great gifts, their magic items and all, they were a result of, you know, Loki, you know, overbetting his abilities and then having to make good on him overstretching himself. And I was curious if he also saw any of the parallels there as well. Hey.
Well, I think there's these are, of course, it's kind of apples and oranges sometimes with trying to put compare the Greco-Roman gods to the Nordic gods, for instance. It doesn't directly translate. And I'm not saying that they, in my view, are necessarily the same. There's a weird tendency, and this is maybe a little bit off topic, but there has been a tendency, you know, to worship Loki, for instance, in some circles. And this really has no historical precedent at all. There is no evidence of Loki ever being revered as a god. And or any really of the children of Loki or any of these sort of chaotic deities, because these were the enemies of man. They were the enemies of the gods and the enemies of order. And it's true that Loki is a catalyst of change in the Eddas, you know, the later collections of these myths. He's the one that always challenges the gods and pulls tricks on them and gets things going. He's the agent of change. But ultimately, he's also the agent of Ragnarök, the twilight of the gods. Right. Ultimately, he becomes chaos, all-devouring chaos, and his children are Fenrir, the wolf, and Jormungandr, the great world serpent, and Surt, the fire demon, and so forth. I mean, these are that clash with the gods of order at the ends of time. So I think I'm not sure about the Hermes. I understand that there's similarities, but I'm not sure that they're quite the same. I think maybe even though Loki is mercurial, I wouldn't say he's Mercury.
Yeah, and oh, I agree. He's not. He's not even in Germanic and Central. It's only in Scandinavia. So somehow he got imported or appeared. You know what I mean? He's again, I would put Odin closer to Hermes than I would Loki. Although Loki, yes, Loki is a trickster without a doubt. Were you going to say something, Graham?
Yeah, no, I was going to agree 100%, and I appreciate him bringing up about how there were no organized worship of Loki, no temples or anything. And I agreed 100%. Is, you know, I was just bringing up Loki as a counterpart, because in a large extent, it's almost like Loki got half of Hermes and Odin got the other half. It's like their portfolios split the responsibilities between Odin and Loki that Hermes had. Tag.
Yeah.
Well, there is hints in the myths of them being blood brothers, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, don't let Marvel fool you. He's not Thor's brother. He's Odin's brother. And there could be a shadow thing, a yin and yang. So theologically, it's very smart how to parse these out. And the adventures of Thor and Loki are hilarious when they cross dress and they go to weddings. And it's like something out of like a buddy cop movie in Hollywood. So I guess Marvel kind of got that right. But
there has been a very strong resurgence in the Norse myths, particularly in recent years, you know, probably because of all the TV series, you know, the Vikings and countless movies and, you know, the whole genres of music and video games and this and that. I mean, and Marvel, of course, and stuff. So, I mean, it is really like these things are still a very important part of our culture.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, from an archetypal point of view, I mean, again, look at World War II and Jung talking about Wotan and, you know, the archetype of war. And of course, these things are manifesting, and our myths and our religious can help us with our collective psychology, whether it's United States, Central America, Europe. We can find a lot of insight. So, but I want to move now to France, to southern France. Tell us about your adventure there and what you found. Was that your first time in Languedoc and those areas, or?
Yes, I mean, I had that was my first time in the Languedoc area, yes, that I write about in the book. And it is a strange thing with that area, because it is, you know, it's an area immersed, the Pyrenees, the mountains of the Pyrenees. It's a really magical area, the mm-hmm. south of France especially, and it is sort of remote from the rest of the world. It is this little pocket of magic in Central Europe that doesn't kind of feel like it truly is part of the modern world in all ways. You know, there's like, it's remote, it's quiet, there's not that many people, the Wi-Fi doesn't work that well, you can walk a whole day without seeing anybody. Wow. And you know, it is really a strange magical area. And then of course it has countless layers of history, and so there are sacred sites upon sacred sites upon sacred sites from different eras. There are holy sites belonging to several different traditions and timelines all at once. There are specific places, pinpoints, that then combine with more contemporary, entire sort of subgenres of literature and modern mythology. And so I sort of approached these things and went to many of these places which had interested me for a long time, and which tie into other things I write about earlier in the book, specifically about Germany. And so it was great to experience some of these things. And of course, you find a lot of wisdom and a lot of folly. You find a lot of things which truly are very powerful and moving, just the real history of places and the things that have taken place in that area, like the Albigensian Crusade, the sort of first modern genocide, it is called, where a bunch of people, I mean, Christians, Cathars, pagans, just so many people were slaughtered because of this sort of rivalry and Catholic, sort of a rivalry between Catholicism and then Catharism, which was a kind of different version of Christianity. So, I mean, you find remnants of these things when you go there, and some of these things, like Montségur, are very moving and very powerful places still today. And it is one of the places that I have since returned to, and that I feel strangely at home in. Maybe it's because I'm a weird person and I you know, feel at home when I'm a little bit in a special place. But there's something sort of comforting about being outside of the modern world. You feel a little safe. You feel somehow like you're out of reach of the tentacles of the negative aspects of the modern world in some sense.
Yeah.
So I write about this in this chapter called Heresy of the book. And I also explore the role of Christianity, Catharism, and the esoteric forms of Christianity that seep into these various places, and also artists' shrines and art and culture of France, not just southern France, but also northern France. So, I have conflicted views, sort of a paradoxical view to it, because on the one hand, I do find that there's a lot of tomfoolery, should we say, happening in that area. You go to, there's places in the Languedoc where you go to a village shop window, like a bread shop, you know, a grocery store, and there's like a UFO with a shovel and crystals and Rennes Le Chateau guidebooks and magnets to find treasures and elf smoking weed, you know, like, and it's just like the most ridiculous, weird, you know, things. And you're like, this is where people buy their bread and butter, you know, for the day. So it's and then you feel, you know, this is quite strange, and there's obviously something very strange happening, bringing all these people into these places. But I mean, this is one of the things I explore in this book, is what is it that brings people into these things? What is it about these places, these sites? It's not just the history. What is it about the nature of these locations that pulls people toward them? And that's really a question I try to explore in this book. The Romans had this concept of genius loci, the spirit of the place, that there is a sort of living spirit that inhabits a certain place. Not every place is the same as every other place. There are different places with different personalities and different natures. And I think southern France and the Pyrenees is certainly a place of high magic and power in various forms. Yeah. And I have since been there, as I said, again, and I write about it also in my next book, which I'm working on now. And I'll probably return, because I do find it to be a high power place.
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of it might be, as we've discussed on the show, there are places that have portals. And again, I think southern France had some ancient portals. Of course, Rennes Le Chateau might have portals. Certainly Portugal has been known. And I've had Patrice Chaplin, Charlie Chaplin's granddaughter, who did these treks, and she found these portals, and people are still doing these rituals. Again, for some reason, the Mediterranean, southern Mediterranean. And she even talks, somebody who you mentioned in your book is Jean Cactus. She said he was part of a secret society who was guarding these portals and doing these rituals. Obviously, Cacteau was very much into the occult, but I think there's something to it. And I think that's, whether it's like you write, Lucifer lost his gem and it fell down and created a portal, the Holy Grail, but there is something about there. And I give the example, Aki, another place you went to, Sintra, which we can talk about. We were driving down from Sintra, and we were just, there's the ocean, and it's like this steep. And my uncle goes, oh, here's a portal. And we're driving with his kids. And what do you mean by a portal? He stops the car in the highway, and the car starts going upward up the road. And I'm freaking out. He says, get out of the car. And we got out, and the car's still going up, and his kids are screaming in the back, and he's laughing. And he's like, oh, yeah, Sintra is just full of all these anomalies, and that, you know, people have just gotten used to them for centuries. So do you think maybe it has to do with these ancient portals, perhaps?
I mean, I don't know. There is something, as I said, I think there's places of power.
Yeah,
I'm not sure where these portals are, you know, what that really means, but there's certainly strange places on Earth. I mean, we experienced this last time. We went there with a very good friend of mine and to a little village, and we were sort of laughing at things. We were sort of, you know, kind of laughing at all the kooky people and the kooky assumptions and things of the you know, like there's these like myths that you hear immediately. Okay, this is this and this is that. But then, you know, the next day, one of these things did happen. Or sort of, you know, became just as it, we were sort of warned. So then we were like, okay, maybe we shouldn't, you know.
Watch your mouth.
yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it is strange. Just when you think it's all folly, then something really strange happens. Even if you're not, you know, a believer or anything, or inclined to be very open to these kinds of things. strange things do happen there. But again, also, there is a huge element of just hearsay and paranoia and cannabis-induced, you know, highfalutin ideas and things which have very little substance outside of being, you know, fantasies. And people are claiming all kinds of things there, I think, more than anywhere else in Europe that I've been. You know, people have, there's a lot of experts on what's happening there and who was part of what secret society and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, it's also, you know, it's a kettle, really, and you have to be a little careful with how you approach it, I think.
Yeah, we're back at this.
And I mean, and there is, like, there are, you know, real esoteric groups and people sort of, that are sort of struggling. You know, there's like constantly some magical wars going on in these areas and between these different groups and villages. So, you know, so I've been told. So, I mean, there is certainly something strange happening over there.
Oh yeah, for sure. But like
I mean, you've had Richard Stanley on, so I mean,
yeah, he lives there and he guides and he does rituals, and I've heard from people without entheogens and all that, he can take you to altered states like that. And my friend Amanda Radcliffe lived there, so yeah, if I were to go, I would ask one of them, show me, separate the wheat from the chaff. Although, like you're saying, Aki, we're back at the trickster, right? On one hand, Hermes and Loki will give you pure bullshit. On the other hand, they will give you the gifts, the secrets of life. So you have to make the choice. And if you get burned, you get burned. If you get gnosis, you get gnosis, right?
Yeah. And I mean, just to give a balanced point of this, people should also check out the project called Perennial Pyrenees, Martin Locker. And he also writes a lot about the sort of folklore and mythology and traditions, little bit more from sort of academic perspective. And I think it's good to have these, you know, a balance of perspectives, you know, to things. You know, we certainly have a role and a part for visionaries and people who are sensitive to things, shall we say it, but we also need, you know, a clear-headed understanding of the historical reality of things.
Yeah, I'd like to read an incident while you were there, if you don't mind, because I found it fascinating. You write, "Some acquaintance of mine who are not part of the New Age crowd have experienced remarkable things and even visions there," Languedoc. "These experiences have not always been easy. A female friend who is initiated into traditional Finnish shamanism told me about her own tribulations. She often avoids studying the history of place she visits in order not to color her experience in advance. Smart. She knew nothing of the history of Montségur and happened upon this place only because her traveling companion insisted on visiting it. Up by the castle ruin, she started to experience flashes of what happened there in the past. She saw a secret room from which something had been taken away by a small group as they escaped down the mountain slope. She saw the men of the group hiding in the forest, but the truly disturbing part of my friend's experience came upon her while descending the mountains. She lost the strength in her legs as the visions were affecting her body in a sense of hearing. She was compelled to stop, sit down, and cry. She could hear the sound of women singing who were clearly in pain. Passersby were baffled as she sat and wept on the path." That was very powerful because, like you said, she had no idea really what she was, right? And the history. You had to explain it to her, right? The burnings and the all that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this Montségur, of course, is a site where the Cathars sort of came to an end and where a large number of them were burned at the end of a 3-month or was it half-year-long siege of the mountain. And this is... was to that date, I believe, the biggest mass execution, mass burning of people. And it's a very, you know, this kind of historical event, of course, gives this place a sort of tragic aura. And there is something to that place. The you know, places remember things. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it was, but even for me, going up there, I didn't really expect anything. But it was just very moving. I just burst into tears coming into this place. It was just so, and I am not a very tearful person. It is not easy for me to become moved like that about things. So there's certainly something to that. And a lot of people have very strong experiences up there. Now, what is it? What is it that touches people? Is it the spirit of the people who used to be there? Some claim that they are, you know, remnants of things. Who knows? But, you know, this was a holy site even before the Cathars. So these mountains and places like this that are high above everything else and that have been holy sites for since as long as anybody can remember, there's certainly a reason why those places are like that. And I'm not sure what that reason is, but there's certainly some places that we can access or something can touch us more than average places do.
Very true. And as you write, even the Nazis were looking, snooping around in those areas with Otto Rahn and others, because the Holy Grail, they knew where power was hiding and they were looking for some of that sweet power, right? According to them. So, and the Romans had been there. So it was an amazing place. Did you see any interesting ideas on the Holy Grail, whether you're there or other places, or what was your take on this?
Well, I mean, Otto Rahn was, just to give a little context, Otto Rahn was a German sort of a researcher. He was not really a national socialist by heart. No. He was a young man and he was given, you know, a poor man, a poet, and he was a historical researcher, and he was given resources by the Nazis to be a part of the Ahnenerbe, which was the ancestral heritage and research department of the SS. And, you know, a young man given unlimited or very large resources to explore the subjects, the Cathars, the Troubadours, the Grail, and go to these locations and look for relics and items and things like this. It's not a clean cut, you know, it was the Nazis looking. It was, of course, specifically Himmler.
Heinrich Himmler was into that.
He was into these things, and he hired all these people to do this. Of course, there was a pressure on Otto Rahn because he, you know, go find the Grail, and then you don't find the Grail, and then it's like, well, you should find something, perhaps. But so I mean, he did die in mysterious circumstances, as far as we know. But anyway, yes, he did explore Montségur, and he believed that the Montségur was the Grail castle that is talked about in Wolfram von Essenbach's Parsifal. And so these are the Troubadour legends, and he relates them to the Troubadour legends and things. Now, I don't know if you asked me, did I find the Grail?
You're selling it for $19.99 online.
Exactly, yeah. Go to my website. Yeah. We can ask ourselves, what is the Grail? And I mean, of course, we have the popular thing about it being the cup into which Jesus' blood was bled. But we also have legends of it being a stone or an emerald that fell from Lucifer's crown when he was cast out of heaven. We have the idea that it might be a book or, some sort of relic of power. Of course, I think the central idea is that the Grail is a symbol of union. Mm-hmm. It is a vessel from which man drinks. So he becomes initiated. He gets a taste of the transcendent or the divine. It is the symbol of unity, of man becoming part or touching the stone, as in other legends. It's the stone that heals, lapsit exilis. So I think the Grail is a symbol, and perhaps the foremost European symbol of spiritual unity, because it is really this cultural thing that combines Christianity and paganism. Because it contains layers of both, and it does represent this sort of ultimate treasure through which man can connect with the higher powers or the divinities or the divine. And I think it's really, really central in why it's in this book. And really, this is the essence also of this chapter that deals with the various forms of the Grail search that has been going on for a long time and still goes on. And although the Grail isn't a tangible object, it can manifest, I think, in forms that we can sort of access, or we can get little shreds or bits of it in a way. So I do think that this is why this is so important.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.